Welcome to this edition of Earthwatch, a transterrestrial program that is concerned about life in ecology, and in this sense, ecology being the entirety of space. My name is Robert Knight, and I'm very happy to be joined now live by Rick Iredam. He is with a tremendous website called marsnow.info. And we have this meeting tonight because of the imminence of the arrival of the NASA craft called Curiosity, which is about to land on the surface of Mars and conduct further studies into the planet. And welcome to Earthwatch, Rick.
Well, thank you. I'm proud to be a part of it.
Well, I'm proud to have you. You are yourself a journalist and engineer, and I can think of no better combination because logic is very much a part of expression, as is precision. And as we'll speak about later in the program, quite a significant author of a monumental study about Hurricane Andrew, something that is always in season, so to speak, and many other projects, both text and audio. But let's just begin with Mars. And I have many questions for you about that. But the initial issue is, of course, the NASA lander that's due to arrive on the 6th of August.
Yeah, and it's going to arrive in the middle of Times Square. And I think that it's absolutely amazing that NASA has been so brave and smart in their efforts to market both the excitement and the significance, the engineering accomplishment of what they're attempting to do here. It's they've never done it before. It's something that you really can't do or even test on Earth because Mars has a different atmosphere. So they're going up there and try to figure out a way to deposit a little car-sized vehicle gently on the surface of Mars using a system that you know, is just dreamed up but never tested. And it's going to be really thrilling to watch it unfold.
Well, the exploration of Mars has a storied history. There was a time not many years ago when I think about three quarters of the missions to Mars from both the United States and the Soviet Union and or Russia were failures. And it apparently is not as easy as it looks. Can you go over the history of the various probes to Mars that have failed and why this becomes all the more significant?
Yeah, what happened here, and it's the important thing, one of the ones to know about. Excuse me. I'm sorry. One of the most recent ones was an orbiter that NASA sent to Mars that was supposed to arrive in 2006. And its purpose was actually to relay back to Earth the vast amount of information that is going to be gathered by the Curiosity rover that's going there now. Unfortunately, the people one of the space agencies,
JPL, perhaps.
No, this wasn't JPL. This was actually the guys at the Skunk Works at Lockheed. They had part of the mission, and then there was another part of the mission that was done by another vendor. And one of them, Lockheed, used the English method of calculations, and the other one used the metric system. And so they shot this thing into, it was supposed to arrive in orbit. This is the last mission to Mars before this one, except that when they tried to put the two sets of instructions together, the little computer on board the spacecraft had no idea what to do because it was, some of it was metric and some of it was furlongs and inches and feet. And so it missed Mars.
Brilliant.
By about 600 miles.
What was the velocity in furlongs per fortnight?
I'm not really sure, but it missed by about 600 miles. And that's important because what's up there now is this the Odyssey, which was launched in 2002 for a different purpose. And it's it's really long survived its lifespan, expected lifespan, but it's the only vehicle that we've got up there that the Curiosity lander can send this vast amount of data to, and then have it stored on board the Odyssey, and then sent back to Earth. And it's in trouble. It's having trouble with its stabilizing units, and they're having trouble getting it aligned. And the concern at this point is that you can go all the way to Mars, actually succeed in this incredible achievement, which is putting this this rover on the planet, and then not ever get a significant amount of data back from it, because the other two orbiters that go around Mars are like, it's the difference between tweeting and sending you a full-length feature film. These other two orbiters, they can take little bits of data. They don't have enough storage to retransmit it. Of course, the Curiosity rover doesn't transmit directly to Earth. It has to send it to a relay.
I understand that is an issue because of the local orbiter, which has been reassigned the transmission of landing data. I understand that there is a horizon problem at critical points during the landing.
Well, that was going to be a problem anyway. And it became more of a problem as they've been trying to adjust. You're talking about one of the great moments in engineering. In 1960, back at Langley, before they even had a satellite in orbit, some engineer sat down and said, you know, how are we going to stabilize these satellites that we want to put out into orbit? How are we going to adjust them so that they will have their antennas pointed in the right direction to be able to transmit it, the data? And they came up with a bunch of different methods, but the method that they arrived at was a modification of a gyroscope. And they actually had three of them, and they spin, and they weigh about 22 pounds. And the physics of the way they spin, you can slow down one, and by slowing down one, it causes the craft to turn in the opposite direction. And by speeding up one, it causes the craft to turn in another direction.
So it's precessional guidance.
Yeah. So you don't have to use thrusters to do that. Well, this particular craft, this Odyssey, I call it the Hag. It's been up there forever, and wasn't really meant to do this. The engineers who designed that somehow or another were able to convince the JPL and NASA to put a fourth wheel on it and to calibrate the wheels so that if one of them failed, the other three could take over. And that's what's just happened. Or else we'd be doomed to a situation like we were with Galileo at Jupiter.
That sounds like that could be brilliant. Does that mean that the three gyroscope wheels are not mutually orthogonal? So that they could, if one failed...
It was so well designed that where you would typically keep this thing on balance by the three, mm-hmm. they added a fourth, right, which was a slave, basically. And but they mounted them at angles so that if any one of the three failed, they could bring the fourth online, and it could account for and adjust for whichever one of the other three failed. It's a brilliant engineering achievement.
Yeah, I can understand.
That's what they've accomplished right now. It's a wonderful thing, except that this new fourth wheel, the slave wheel, the mechanical gyroscopic wheel, it's kind of having problems right now too. So they're sort of nursing it around, nursing it along. But even if all three worked well and the antennas were all pointed in the right direction, everything was fine, the crater, the Gale crater that the Curiosity is going to land in, is so deep that there's a horizon that gets between the spacecraft and the Odyssey, which creates a delay of a few minutes. When it passes over this or underneath this horizon, and that's this whole 7 minutes of terror, which is actually much longer than that, where they everything that begins to happen when this craft enters the atmosphere of Mars is all automated, and is a really complex sequence of events that involves 76 explosions, all of which have to take place at exactly the right second. They use pyrotechnics because it's just a more dependable way of doing things than any other way to change or to dislodge the heat shield, for example, from the spacecraft. Well, if those pyrotechnics don't go off at that point, or if only three out of four go off, then it stays attached and things get messy. And if they have a little mortar that fires out this huge supersonic parachute. And if that doesn't work, then they don't have a parachute. And then when it all gets down to done, and they're hanging this rover from these three cables, and the second it touches the ground, there's a message that's sent up to the spacecraft that says, please blow up these little cables, so they're no longer attached to the sky crane. And if that doesn't happen, when the sky crane goes flying off over the horizon, it takes the lander with it. The number of these little tiny things that have to happen in sequence are dazzling and frightening.
Well, the approach to landing on Mars is quite different than one would approach on Earth because of the difference in the atmospheric density, although Mars is pretty close to Earth in terms of size and gravitational attraction, and even axial tilt to the ecliptic. And the use of a parachute is not quite as obvious as it is here, is it?
It's just a much bigger parachute.
Bigger parachute, right?
Thinner air, bigger parachute, exactly. they were able to test it at 200,000 feet, I think, where the atmosphere of the Earth was fairly close to the relative low density of the atmosphere in Mars. But the thing about it that actually troubles me that I haven't written about it yet, but I plan to write about, is that all the testing that they've done on this vehicle as it comes plummeting toward Mars from 23,000 miles an hour, in 7 minutes they reduced the speed to 3 miles an hour. So that's an enormous deceleration that's going on.
That's about the average human walking speed.
Right, exactly. That's what they've got to do. They have to slow this thing down that much. And the parachute is a significant part of that. But what they never tested the vehicle for, because they couldn't, was that when the craft is traveling at about 12,000 miles an hour, the heat shield works, and then it slows it down to maybe 1,000 miles an hour, and then this supersonic parachute comes out. And what it does is it yanks the spacecraft back, as you'd expect a parachute to do. And I've looked through all the studies and the resources and the research that's been done on the mission and the evaluations and there's a million different scrutinies that are involved in this, and nobody has asked the question of, can the spacecraft withstand being yanked backwards from 1,000 miles an hour to less than 100 miles an hour? That's enormous deceleration, because there was no way to test that type of a deceleration, and that's really, to me, going to be the key moment in this in the landing, is when that chute deploys, and all of a sudden this apparatus is brought to a screeching halt, basically going backwards when it's been going forwards for all these months. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens there, and of course we won't know for 22 minutes. Because Mars is that distance from the Earth, nobody will know here whether any of this stuff worked until it's over.
Our guest is Rick Iordan of the website marsnow.info, a treasure trove of information relevant to the current Mars Curiosity project. And Rick, the landing of the device is itself quite a drama. What is the purpose of this particular rover? We've seen basically a lot of pictures of red rocks and pink skies in panorama. But is there something different or new about the mission package of the Curiosity rover?
Well, they kind of take turns. This is the geologist's mission. Well, you remember the Viking mission to Mars? That was the biologists' mission. The experiments that they soft-landed on Mars in 1976 were all designed, or primarily designed, to go looking for microbes, living organisms, or at least the traces of living organisms. And there was a huge battle that went on. Bruce Murray was a geologist and ended up running JPL and forming the Planetary Society. But he and the what they called the exobiologist fought tooth and nail over the Viking program because he thought it was a waste of time to be looking for this foolish stuff. And he thought it was a waste of time and money to have to sterilize the Viking landers thoroughly so that they couldn't corrupt the Mars. Now, this next mission, the one we're talking about now, Curiosity, is what Murray wanted in the first place. It's something Carl Sagan talked about at the end of the Viking mission. And what it is it's a geologist experiment. And it's so much of a geologist experiment that it has a prime directive, like in Star Trek. If it detects anything that even seems like it's alive, it's not allowed to go anywhere near it. And the reason why it's not allowed to go anywhere near it is because it wasn't sanitized sufficiently so that it could not corrupt a Martian life form. And then, of course, it has the nuclear reactor, which would also potentially contaminate a Martian life form. So it's going to go up there, and it's going to do what geologists do. It's going to break little rocks apart, and it's got wonderful equipment, gas chromatograph, mass spectrometers, and X-ray examiners, and all kinds of things that do a chemical and visual analysis of the rocks and the clay and the strata, and it's going into that hole, the Gale Crater, because in that hole there are great echelons of sediment, like we have in the Grand Canyon, where you look up the wall of the Grand Canyon and you see layer after layer after layer of deposited history, and that's what it's going to do. The theory is that we need to know this geology, because then we can believe what Viking told us, which was that there's actually evidence of life on Mars. But without understanding that geology, we can't understand how it can live there. It has to find, so they'll look for water. It'll look for where water used to be. And most importantly, it's going to look for carbon. Because when Viking was there, they found all kinds of activity that looked like respiration and metabolism, but they couldn't find any carbon. They couldn't find any organic carbon anywhere on the surface of the planet. And the assumption was that the place would be full of carbon just because meteors deposit organic material that has a carbon basis to it, even though it may not be alive. And then they didn't find any. I mean, not at all. So the first step is to confirm the presence of water and make some sense out of how long ago the water was there or whether it's there now. And the second part of it is to try to figure out if there is, in fact, some leftover carbon, which might suggest a residual of life forms on the planet. It's astounding. I mean, carbon is the root of the galaxy. Everything that goes on in the universe has some carbon in it, and it's been remarkable that they could not find carbon on Mars on these other missions. And the only way they can actually find it is to send this particular Curiosity rover to prove it's there. If they find carbon, then it pretty much answers the question that was raised in Viking. They found all these processes with Viking that looked like life, but they said, well, they can't be life because there's no water on Mars, and they can't be life because we can't find any organic waste. And things that live and then die leave behind organic waste. And over the years, those arguments have been set aside because now we know there's lots of water on Mars. So the only big question that's left is, where's the carbon? And that's what Curiosity is going to go and find.
This is Earthwatch. Originating at WBAI on the Pacifica Radio Network, we're speaking with Rick Iordan. And he is with the website marsnow.info. And Rick, in the event that there were to be found residua of organic chemistry of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen combined along with the water, I'm kind of troubled by the energy source of this particular probe. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration heretofore has been using solar panel power for its probes of Mars. And I speak with people who, like my colleague Carl Grossman and others, who are perturbed that not only is a nuclear reactor being used to provide energy for this monitor, but that a particularly active isotope of plutonium mm-hmm. is being used for it. So, is that not a an implicit assumption that there is no life on Mars? And if there is, and I'm not asserting that there is, but why in hell did NASA switch from solar to nuclear with this satellite, this probe?
The solar works well in orbit. I don't know. I forget. I think the other rovers are in fact solar powered. But their problem was that Mars is a nasty place, and unless you can add an additional component to your rover to keep your solar panels clean, they just don't function for long. You know, they need to be as shiny and responsive as possible. The two guys that are still the Spirit and the other one that are still limping around are just dazzling.
Are you saying, Rick, that they could not invent a solar windshield wiper?
You know, they could, it's just one more thing to add to the array. I would think you could have a can of air the Vikings missions did have a can of air to blow off the film off of their cameras. If I remember correctly, the Vikings had nuclear power source too, although it wasn't plutonium and it wasn't designed to last as long as this one is, or to drive as many functions. I think that you could, if Joshua Lederberg was still around, or Carl Sagan, or some of the early champions of planetary sanitation were still around to fight this battle, there might have been a real issue over this. NASA's admitting that it's a potential threat. God forbid it runs into a pile of life somewhere that it doesn't expect. Its prime directive is to stay away from anything that looks alive. So if it comes up against and it's got a long viewing lens and devices, my co-author, Dr. Gilbert Levin, has pointed out on a lot of occasions that you can just look at rocks on Mars where they have constant long-term examination, and you can see how much they look like lichens. They go from gray to green, they change in shape, they change in size. There's nothing that isn't alive that we know of that behaves quite like these things on some of the rocks that have been scrutinized on Mars. And I'm guessing that Curiosity, if it encounters a rock that looks like that, is going to be instructed to stay away.
Because there
really is a across the realm. The Russians aren't so good about it, but there's across the realm. It says you cannot go to some other planet and kill the natives,
unless the Martian natives come in the direction opposite the direction of the telescope.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Unless they come from behind, and then it could actually be true that Curiosity killed the Martian cat.
Yeah, you're right, and worse yet, that Curiosity, by the exposure to radiation, to some basic life forms that microbiology, altered their genetic state and changed them, mutated them into being something that they would have never become had they not been exposed to plutonium-38. And this is really important. I'm glad we got to this. To find life on Mars, almost everybody thinks that if it's not there, we'll be able to find traces of it. There's just too many things around that look like life on Earth and on the Mars meteors, and you know, the odds are it's probably there. And when they find it there, or if they find it there, the real important question is it different than life on Earth? And there's actually a way to answer that question conclusively. This experiment doesn't do this. Now, my co-author, Dr. Gilbert Levin, had an experiment that he offered to NASA that they declined. He was the guy who found the evidence of life on Mars in the Gulliver experiment, the label release. But that the Russians actually had on their last mission to Mars, which crashed. And what it does is it identifies a thing called chirality. If you take your left hand and your right hand and you put them together, they look alike, but they're actually 100% different. And on Earth, we've got 22 amino acids that are used to make up the essence of life. It has a lot to do with DNA and reproduction. There are thousands of them, but there are only 22 that are involved in the life process. So that's the first thing. Let's check how many amino acids the critter has on Mars. And if he's got 29, then he's different than life on Earth. The other thing you're going to check, though, is that which way do the amino acids rotate? If they're left-handed, like they are on Earth, then this is a very similar life form to what we have on Earth. If they're right-handed, then this is a dramatically different life form than we have on Earth. And it tells us then that the universe is full of dramatically different life forms. So that's, you know, you can go there, and if you find something that's just like a microbe on Earth, you haven't learned anything. Because we know that all this stuff flies from planet to planet, with these planetary impacts, and we got all these Martian
condites from the moon, all kinds of rocks from space.
That, you know, you don't really discover life in the galaxy until you discover different life in the galaxy, and that, in my opinion, is what we really should have focused on this mission, and certainly on the next time we spend this kind of money. The experiment already exists. Like I said, my co-author, Dr. Levin, has invented it and tested it. Or you can go out and check chirality and check amino acids, and now we know something. Now we know that Mars life is pretty much like life on Earth. Maybe it started there and came here. Maybe it started here and came there. Maybe it started in somewhere else and went to both places, and that's okay. But if we find life on Mars that's different at this significant level, this Francis Crick, who was the guy who invented who discovered the DNA, he suggested this when he won the Nobel Prize in 1960, that how important this distinction is, and it's been out there as a challenge to NASA and to the biologists over the years, but it keeps getting pushed back for the lesser discovery of just a life form up there. And then, yeah, the geologists. It's the geologists' time. It's been a big fight between the geologists, the engineers, and the biologists over who's going to control which mission. And this one here is the one that the geologists won.
Well, this is getting more fascinating by the moment. We're speaking with Rick Iordan of MarsNow.info, and this on the occasion of the imminent arrival of the NASA rover called Curiosity. And Rick, at this point of discussing the possibility of organic compounds that may or may not be found at this point in time on Mars, you spoke about something very important, that there is interplanetary communication through high-velocity impacts that create ejecta that exceed the escape velocity of a particular body.
Yes, sir.
These are able to go into orbit and be perturbed over long periods of time sometimes and arrive at different planets. The Earth is scattered with residue from elsewhere. Other planets are too. And something that seems necessary to be brought into context here is the areology. See, I didn't say geology because that's for Earth. The areology of Mars is is astonishing because, as I recall, the southern, what we call the southern hemisphere, is on average several miles higher than the plains of the northern hemisphere,
right,
which begs the speculation that at one point there was some petrophlegm that was sneezed onto one face of the planet Mars, and as angular momentum would require, with the extra weight or mass or inertia of this extra stuff that got put on only one half of Mars. See, no matter which side it hit, Mars would eventually stabilize into an orbit where the centroid or center of mass would be at one of the poles or
right
nearby. So, we're talking about interplanetary exchanges. So please help us understand that areological difference between the Martian hemispheres.
Well, I don't, and this is the geologists again. And this is one of the good things that they probably will do there. Bruce Murray, who ran JPL and is the president of the Planetary Society, and is a great geologist and a great scientist, he believed in he espouses a theory of planetary accretion, which is pretty widespread among the planetary geologists, and that says that all these planets start as dust, and they get to be bigger dust, and they get to be bigger dust, and then they're rocks, and then they plow into each other, and then they get to a certain mass, and then that certain mass is sufficient to create a magnetic field. You get a magnetic field, then it starts to spin, and you've got your momentum, and then they keep getting banged into other things. And in the case of the Earth, you have a lot of heavy metals that were deposited along with some really interesting things, like probably about 100 million tons of diamonds, in the Earth's structure. And that all is drawn to the center by this gravity over time. But what we don't know, and what doesn't appear to be clear yet about Mars, is whether it has any plate tectonics. Now, it looks like it was there's no question it was geologically active. There are issues about whether or not it had oceans, but whether those oceans were primary oceans, as we suspect they were on Earth, or whether they were secondary oceans, nobody knows. That's part of what I think Curiosity is going to tell us. And so if Mars never had any plate tectonics, then it may not be done wobbling into its circular shape yet. Or if it does have plate tectonics, and that process has now ended because there's not enough weight in the core, then maybe it's just wobbling out of shape. You just don't know. Every time they go somewhere and get closer, it amazes me. If you go back and read, I've got a book that's posted on the Mars Now website. It's called Truth or Lore, 60 Years of NASA Search for Life in Outer Space. When they first got near Mars back in the 70s with the Mariner program, the cameras that they used were basically flying fax machines. And they took these images a line at a time and sent them back very slowly. Well, of course, they were distorted because you had two moving targets, one that was the camera and one that was the planet. And they got these really blurry, bad images of Mars that convinced everybody that it looked just like the moon. And then they went into all the planning for the next generation of the missions to Mars based on the idea that they were going to some place that didn't have any significant geology in it. And it was only when they got better cameras and better focus and better depth of field that they were able to realize that Mars is much more interesting. And that's what happened with Galileo when it found all these fascinating moons around Jupiter. And I think that the moons of Jupiter are much more interesting than Mars right now. Frankly, there's all kinds of cool stuff going on out there. There's one that's definitely got an ocean under a sheet of rock, of ice. You know, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But what happened in Mars's history is important to the study of the advancement of the theory of planetary accretion. And that was a big deal for Bruce Murray. Why it's the way it is, you know, you got those two little weird planets floating around out there, the moons, and they're very strange. And they may be that missing lump of Mars that got dislodged.
This is exactly where I wanted our discussion to go. Rick Iredam of MarsNow.info. And I might as well spring the second reveal here, after the hemispheric difference on Mars. And aside from the altitudinal anomaly between the north and southern hemispheres of Mars, there is something else that is wonderfully odd and coincidentally perfect in terms of orbital dynamics.
Oh, yeah?
And that is the two satellites of the planet Mars, mm-hmm. Deimos and Phobos, one of them, moving so rapidly and so low that it seems to be counter-orbital in reference to the rest of the celestial sphere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's doing that at what one might think of as the lower limit before atmospheric friction.
Right.
Would bring it down. So it's as low as it can orbit.
And
the other one is at a perfect gravitational balance for, let's say, you wanted to save on propulsion. You launch components to the lower satellite and then have a transfer system to the higher one where you are at even less gravitational influence from the massive body of Mars, and you can escape easier into space. A double platform orbital launching system is what Deimos and Phobos are.
Off of Mars, you're saying?
Yes.
Not on the way there necessarily.
No. But getting back from the surface of Mars, they provide a means of minimizing the energy of launch and orbit achievement.
Right.
What do you make of that?
I've never thought about it that way. I had a long conversation with Gerald Stoffen, who was the Viking project manager at JPL during the Viking era, because that was when they, what happened there was that when they had this storm on Mars and they couldn't land, Carl Sagan convinced them to go ahead and change the path of the Viking landers so that they could pass by, the Mariner, so they could pass by Phobos and Deimos. The geologists were second string then, and the biologists were first string, and they said, well, we don't want to waste our fuel. We don't want to waste our time doing this. But they went there. They had the cameras were not correctly calibrated. And one thing that Sagan was pretty good with was actually working with cameras. And so he worked overnight.
Now that's really funny.
I know, isn't it? But that was really one of the best things he did was. Well, you have to. It's because he was an astronomer, and as an astronomer, you really get good with cameras. Because what you see with your eye is okay, but what you can record on some type of a recording device is even more important. And so he talked him into going over and taking a look at those moons while they were waiting for the storm to subside on Mars. And they got there and they got these bad pictures. And then he worked overnight with this other guy, I forget his name, and got the images, you know, crystal clear. And they were so dramatic. That there are horizontal lines that are gouged in across 50% of Deimos that looks like a giant cat has reached out a claw and just scratched it all the way across, but they don't go all the way across, and then this potato shaped Phobos has this huge meteor impact on it. Which survives, and it's so big that they cannot figure out how possibly this little rock in space could have withstood meteorite impact of that without blowing into pieces. And those two things remain mysteries. And when I was talking to Soffin back in 1976, he was all cranked up about how they were going to find out all about Phobos and Deimos. And then NASA kind of pitched it aside. The Russians got interested in it. That's where their mission was going to go, actually. But there's some weird stuff going on those little moons.
This is Earthwatch. We're speaking about Mars, Phobos, Deimos, and Curiosity. And our guest is Rick Iredam of MarsNow.info. And there have been numerous missions that have attempted to reach Mars, as we established earlier in the program. And given the communications complexity of those few missions that did make it to Mars, would it be useful to have an observation device that would land on the Martian side of one of the one or both of these satellites for a stable and persistent platform
of observation?
You know, because the moon, because of the vibration and the attraction of the more massive side of the moon to always face the Earth, the same principle, I think, would apply to the satellites there. So why are there not observational bases on these two satellites? Or, I mean, observational bases from Earth.
If the Russians hadn't launched their Phobos Grunt mission right into the middle of a coronal mass ejection and pointed the solar orienting camera directly at this ultraviolet explosion on the sun and burned out their little computer, there might be one there, you know, but because that's where they were going. And that would have been really good. I think they were going there just to test their ability to land on a small space. And I'm guessing it, once they went there, they were probably going to hop over to Mars. But that might have been it. We know how to do satellites pretty well, except for Mars. I mean, we keep missing Mars. And this, like I said, the array that's up there now to transmit the information back from Curiosity, which is transmitting the information back from the other little rovers, that's not what they were designed for. There was a whole other spacecraft that was sent to Mars to do this function that they missed. You know, it's like, oops. So they had to rely on these different types of the different orbiters that are there, and it didn't make any difference for the little rovers because they don't really gather that much data or images. But it makes a big difference. It's going to make a big difference for Curiosity because it's in the position to gather tons and tons of data. I'll give you. I meant to mention this before. You know, this wonderful Galileo spacecraft that they sent to Jupiter. Very expensive, very long mission. And it stayed in the vicinity of Jupiter for well over a year and gave us some of these dramatic photographs that we had from Jupiter. Just dazzling. But it failed. They couldn't open up its main antenna. And they reprogrammed its little antenna. But what this meant was that for all the time it was there, and they were dazzling images, but they only sent back 1,400 pictures. For all the while it was there, for the entire cost of that mission, that's all that they could transmit because that's all they could store in the and send. And even at that, they took forever to get here. And that's one of the things that really worries me about this situation with Curiosity. If it lands, you know, let's all hope it does, you know, safe and sound, and all of its transmitters work, and it still relies on the Odyssey orbiter to send back the significant amount of data. And that guy's an old dude, and they're having trouble keeping him pointed straight. And if he fails, the last of his orientation wheels is in place. And if they can't get him to shoot back all this to store and then send us back all the information from Curiosity, they've got these other two little things. And like I said earlier, they can tweet what Curiosity is finding, but they can't send us the type of science that Curiosity was designed for. You know?
Well, Rick, can you put into perspective the difference between the American and the Soviet-Russian space program in terms of, is there any measurable philosophical difference in the targets that are chosen or the
approach? Not anymore.
Approach?
But you know, you had Oprin, who was had the first theory of chemical evolution. And at the time, in the 1920s, the theory of chemical evolution said basically, if you take enough chemicals and you hit them with a lightning bolt and you got a billion years and it happens over and over again, sooner or later, life forms and you don't need God. And that works really good for dialectic materialism. And then they started actually testing that theory scientifically, and they found out you could do it. Urey and Miller and so on did it. And then Haldane came out with a similar theory. And that's really got everybody launched in the idea that we could probably find life in outer space because all it took was a billion years and a lot of accidents. So they were...
That's funny.
They were on their way to go to either the moon or Venus and Mars because it withstood their dialectic materialistic agenda in those days of Marxist communism. The other thing about them, though, is that they're... Fabergé aside, they're really bad at miniatures. The Russians just don't do well with miniaturization. So the reason why
Saturday Night Live, the famous joke,
new Soviet minicam,
and the camera operator has something that looks like a suitcase on his shoulder.
Yeah, well, there you got it. And so because they couldn't miniaturize their instruments, they maximize their rockets. And so we sent up a little, our little satellite, and they sent up a 5-ton orbiter right after a month after Sputnik, because they've always had this great lifting ability. They still have more lifting ability than we do. But they don't have it because they necessarily need to. I mean, not because they want bigger rockets than we do. It's just that they can't build little tiny instruments. The Viking, the entire life search experiment, and there were three of them, on the Viking landers would fit in a milk carton. I mean, not the milk carton like a half a gallon of milk, but those little square milk cartons that you used to get that had 3 gallons in them or 4 gallons in them. You know, it was 2 feet by 2 feet, weighed 25 pounds. And in that one, you had a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer, which is like... Abby Shuto's got in her lab her favorite instrument, and she figures out everything on. It's this really pretty giant, big analysis piece of equipment that she has in NCIS. Mm-hmm. Well, they made one of those that was about this, a little bit bigger than two cigarette packs.
Well, let us hope that in this issue of the magnitude of package of missiles that are used for interplanetary exploration that... the competition between nations does not succumb to Venus envy.
I think we may be over that by now. I don't know.
We're speaking with Rick Iredam of MarsNow.info. And Rick, let me take this moment for you to tell our listeners about the wonderful variety of information that is on your website and your work with Dr. Levin, and give us a briefing on who you are as a purveyor of Martian information.
Well, I appreciate that opportunity. Strangely enough, I covered the Viking program for the National Enquirer. I used to do a lot of the science stuff back in the heyday of the National Enquirer. And it was good because the Enquirer, as opposed to other publications I worked at, if you came up with a good idea from a story, they didn't say, that can't be right. They'd say, well, go check into it, right? And in this case, Levin told Science News that this data that he got back from his Viking experiment, if he got that data back from Earth, he'd say there was life on Earth. He said this to a science writer who didn't answer the follow-up question. And I went, wait a minute, what's this guy trying to say? And so I checked on it, and that's what he said. If they got the same data on Earth that they got on Mars, they'd say there was life on Earth. And so I went to the Enquirer and I said, well, they had to have held a contest to have the best experiment. They must have made some claims about what they could do to find and discover and do the scientific method. Let me go find out. And as it turns out, they did have a contest, and these very brilliant people, Horowitz and Levin and Lederberg and Vishniak, and interesting bunch of people, they sent these experiments up there. Well, Levin's was the one that really had the best non-controversial results. But Levin was a sanitary engineer. He's not he wasn't a noble scientist. He didn't have a PhD. The experiment that he developed, he'd actually developed to find whether water was polluted by labeling it with a little bit of a nuclear substance, and then reading the gas that the labeled carbon-14 that came off of it. Anyways, it doesn't matter. But the point is that it was a real simple idea, and it worked. But he wasn't. But these other guys were all Nobel Prize winners and super scientists and everybody else, and they really treated him like crap. And in the end, they all agreed that he was right, except they couldn't find carbon, and there was no water on Mars. But they were going to be able to prove that he was wrong in the laboratory. This was in the 1970s, right? Certainly in 2 or 3 years, Soffin told me, right? Well, they never have proved that he was wrong. And ever since then, I have been following NASA, all the space science, all the experiments, everything that's been going on, waiting to find, really tracking the refutation of Levin's discovery or not. And so I've got 30-some years invested in it. And he and I have stayed in touch over this time. And now that they found water, now that almost everybody agrees that what his experiment said was true, I want to make sure that he's vindicated. Because this guy, and he's in his 80s, he's a great old guy, he's very smart, and he deserves the credit. And what my ambition for him is that there's an exhibit at the Smithsonian of the Viking lander. And on it says, Viking lander went to Mars, didn't find any life, basically. And I want it changed. I want it to say Viking lander went to Mars and found evidence of life on Mars, because that's the truth. And so the we started writing this. I've been doing the research, but we've been writing this book together to explain how it is that they could go for so long and get everything so wrong. And it's a lot of politics, a lot of infighting between the different institutions, between JPL and Langley and Ames and Goddard and people and politics and Wernher von Braun and it all comes down to bottom line. In his case, he was a sanitation engineer. He didn't have a Nobel Prize. He didn't even have a PhD. And they would not let a guy like that make the biggest discovery in the history of science, which is that there's evidence of life on Mars.
Well, the discovery of life on Mars depends to a large extent on the presence of intelligence on Earth.
A wonderful answer.
Tell us about the website. The
website is all about this, actually. What happened was that he and I started talking about this Curiosity mission, and I was actually thought about filing a suit to prevent it from being launched, because A, it didn't have the chirality, the real definitive experiment on it, and B, they're shooting it off into the middle of this solar storm. You know, we're at a major solar phase right now, where these huge coronal mass ejections are going out into space. And we're talking about millions of tons of plasma, electrically charged plasma, traveling at millions of miles an hour. And here's this poor little spacecraft that they're sending off to Mars, right? And it's getting pulverized by this stuff. And NASA keeps saying, it's okay, it's not really bothering it, right? And I'm going, I'm not so sure about that. So what I've been doing is, I've talked to the guys at JPL about it, Guy Webster, who's been very good, and I said, I'm going to report on this side of the story, which is the risks that are the threats to the Curiosity mission. And bless his heart, I knew they couldn't do the solar issue because they should have never launched it. When it was supposed to be launched, which is 2009, there were no solar storms. they didn't have to prepare for this sort of thing, right? But because they missed their deadline and they had to launch in this year, now they're going, this spacecraft is going to endure all kinds of really bad stuff.
If I can parenthecate here, Rick, the synodic cycle of Earth and Mars is on the order of roughly 2 years, give or take.
Right.
That means that they are collinear with the sun or at the same longitude every 2 years or so, and that's why missions are phased that way. And some people used to think that's why there was a two-year periodicity in the Fourier analysis of UFO reports, but that's not what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah. Well, they go. It's a shorter mission, and then it's a shorter transmission time if they time this on these two-year cycles.
By the way, actually, the closer approach of Mars actually would make it slightly brighter, and maybe people would misperceive it as UFO.
That
makes sense.
They should be out there tonight, by the way. There's a nice Mars out there, and there's a Perseid meteor shower going on.
Mars, Saturn, and Vega are in a beautiful triangle right now. Yeah. And the western horizon near sunset.
And the Perseids are out there now, and they're much, much brighter than they usually are, and there are many more of them. It's like 100 an hour, they're saying.
We speak frequently on this program about that with our dear friend and colleague, Steve Cates, drsky.com.
And, I love it.
Yeah.
That's good.
And you are Rick Iredam of MarsNow.org. And I'm interrupting you, but I just wanted to make that note there. Go ahead.
It's the end of my time, I know that. But so the website was a lot of people, Mark Kaufman at Washington Post, a lot of people have come around and understood that what Gil did that long ago has now been stood up pretty well. But there was really no repository for a coherent explanation of what has gone on in the exploration of Mars, what's going on now with the threats against the Curiosity mission. There's some wonderful graphics, the seven hours of terror and all this other stuff. So what I did was I put that website up so that when somebody like you calls me up and says something, I said, now, here's what you do. You go to if you're interested in carbon and how it matters in the universe, you can go to that website and search carbon, okay? And it will give you, it'll take you to a place in the documents that I have there that explain to you coherently why carbon matters. And I'm putting it up there now for, it's amazing. I heard poor, what's her name? The great interviewer on NPR, the lady who's on 10 and 11.
I wish I listened.
It's terrible that I don't remember her name. She's a very good interviewer. I heard her interviewing somebody about Mars the other day, and she hasn't a clue about any of this stuff. And that was what I've experienced with most science writers. All these editors are going to have all this information to write about now, and they're not going to understand what the hell anybody's talking about. So now they can go to this website, which was authored by me, and I'm an award-winning journalist and science writer and all this other stuff. And Gilbert Levin, who is the guy who found life on Mars and is an engineer and scientist, they can go there and have almost anything they need explained in a context that they can then put it in an article, and the rest of the world will understand what the hell they're talking about. Because if you start asking these scientists and geologists what's going on, they speak Fed speak. I mean, it's gibberish. You don't get a coherent answer out of them at all.
Well, I'm very grateful for the clarity that you've brought to the subject of Mars tonight.
I appreciate your inviting me to do it.
And also being with a fellow engineer and keeping a close eye on our neighbors.
Well, I'll be glad to come back, and I'll hook you up with Gil Levin, who's an engineer also.
Oh, I'd love that.
On the flip side of the mission, maybe.
Excellent. Well, we'll keep our eyes to the sky. And thank you so much for your generosity and information tonight.
All right. Well, thank you for your kindness, and you had great questions.
All right. Rick Iredam of MarsNow.info. This is Earthwatch on WBAI, Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM.